California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger travels to Washington this morning looking for cash. The governor's plan to erase California's $20 billion budget deficit relies on billions of federal dollars. And if he doesn't get the money, the governor plans to eliminate entire social services programs. John Myers of member station KQED has more.
Arnold Schwarzenegger has long called himself the collectinator, the guy who would settle a long-standing beef that California sends more money to D.C. than it gets back in federal help. Just days after being elected in 2003, Schwarzenegger met with then-President Bush in Southern California and made it sound as though things were about to change.
We are paying for each dollar that we pay, we only get 77 cents back. So there's room to play with. I mean, so I'm absolutely convinced that we can get help and that we will get help.
But even as recently as 2 weeks ago, he was still asking for the money.
I promised the people of California that I will be fighting for California and I will go and do everything that I can to get the federal money that we deserve.
That was the governor at the unveiling of his new state budget. In that budget, Schwarzenegger has actually penciled in almost $8 billion in federal dollars to balance California's books. That includes money for health care for the poor and welfare assistance, for special education programs, and reimbursement for housing prison inmates who are undocumented immigrants.
For us to get stuck with the bill of incarceration of undocumented immigrants of $900 million is unfair. We're going to fly to Washington and we're going to fight for that money.
Lately, the governor's been fighting mostly with members of his own congressional delegation, jabbing them for not doing more to level the playing field for California. Now, they are jabbing back.
That whole premise that somehow California is being disproportionately treated is just false.
Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, a Democrat from Silicon Valley, says for one thing, Schwarzenegger is using old data. She says a recent review that takes into account federal stimulus money suggests California is getting as much as $1.45 in federal services for every dollar in taxes. Lofgren says while the state's sluggish economy could still use help, Governor Schwarzenegger is spending too much time blaming the feds.
To pretend that he's not the governor and somehow he doesn't have a role in the continuing saga of the California budget nightmare is really a disappointment.
Others say the governor is asking for the wrong money the wrong way. That's because dozens of states find their budgets in the red this year, and Schwarzenegger would be smart to have allies in the fight for federal help. Gene Ross leads the California Budget Project, which advocates for programs aimed at the working poor.
If you want to win the support of Congress, our governor should be going to Washington arm in arm with the 45 other governors who are also facing budget shortfalls this year.
Ross says the governor should focus his D.C. lobbying on a second national stimulus package. In the first one, California was awarded $85 billion, more than any state. But Schwarzenegger said last week another stimulus doesn't solve the problem.
We are not looking for one-time revenue. We are not looking for two-times revenue. We are looking for fairness.
The question, though, is if Arnold Schwarzenegger hasn't gotten what he's wanted from the feds in the past, what makes him think he will get it now? After all, he's in the final year of his term, his job approval ratings are near rock bottom, and the only place more divided by partisan politics than his statehouse may be the nation's capital. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
The number of Americans filing bankruptcy rose substantially last year. Many who sought relief were middle-class Americans who lost jobs, saw their businesses fail, or found themselves facing foreclosure. Bankruptcy is never pretty, but it can provide a fresh start for those who need it. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
By the time Linda Frake sought help from a bankruptcy lawyer, she owed about $150,000 on her credit cards, and the former corporate manager turned entrepreneur was getting deeper and deeper in debt. She tried to work out a repayment plan, but things did not go smoothly, and Frakes began to think that bankruptcy might be the only way out.
It wasn't something that I thought I would ever even consider, let alone actually follow through with. It seemed like the scarlet letter to me.
The single mother in her 50s who'd been living an upper-middle-class life in Atlanta was both terrified and depressed.
Up until that point in my life, I really had defined myself by how successful I was. And it was really, really difficult for me to come to the realization that I had gotten myself into this situation and wasn't able to figure it out. So to me, the equation was I wasn't as smart as I thought I was.
Frakes, who's written about her late 2008 bankruptcy in a self-published book, owned several successful businesses. But market conditions changed, and she couldn't sell them as she'd planned. She resorted to credit cards to keep herself and her businesses afloat. Then the other shoe dropped. Someone who owed her a lot of money as part of a business deal quit paying.
What was left of the income that I was living off of disappeared, and now I was scrounging just to pay daily living expenses. And that's when I became trapped.
Business failures are at the root of many personal bankruptcies. So are serious illnesses, divorce, a death in the family, and increasingly, the loss of a job. Some who turn to bankruptcy are simply deadbeats, but most are not, says Seattle bankruptcy lawyer Gloria Nagler.
Believe me, people don't come into my office saying, "Whoopee, I get to file bankruptcy."
If they use Chapter 13 of the Bankruptcy Code, they sign on to debt repayment plans and in return get to keep certain assets. Those in more dire financial straits can try filing under Chapter 7. Assets are sold to pay off debts, and what can't be paid is absolved. Nagler says the would-be filers that she sees are often so embarrassed by their predicament, they can't even look her in the eye.
I quickly, you know, let them know that it's not a moral failing. My God, the economy's falling apart all around us. There's so many people filing bankruptcy. I have twice the business. I can't even return all the calls. And every lawyer in town who's done bankruptcy is having the same situation.
Nationwide, personal bankruptcy filings rose to 1.4 million last year, about 30% more than the year before. And the number isn't likely to fall sharply anytime soon. In Seattle, for example, there are so many requests for free debtor counseling that the local bar association holds twice weekly sessions just for those considering bankruptcy.
Hi, my name's John Farver, and I can be your attorney tonight for a half hour, and I can give you any advice and assistance I can.
Over the next 2 hours, Farver and two other volunteer bankruptcy lawyers listen to stories like that of a well-dressed young woman who'd lost her high-paying job, and her new position doesn't pay enough to cover her bills. Still, her wages are being garnished. Another woman, a scientist, had become ill and couldn't work for a while. Then a sizable contract she was working on got canceled.
So many people who have lost their job and all of a sudden, you know, can't afford what they easily could have afforded 6 months ago. Well, those people need to have their own personal bailout, you know, just like the fat cats on Wall Street.
In 2005, Congress overhauled the nation's bankruptcy laws, intending to limit the number and scope of individual bankruptcy filings. But in this tough economy, the law has had limited effect, as huge numbers of Americans are legally shedding debt and hoping for a fresh start. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
And one of the ways states have tried to cut budget deficits is by closing interstate rest stops, I guess on the theory that every little bit counts. Virginia shut down its highway stops, but yesterday the state announced that it's reopening 19 of them. NPR's Adam Hochberg has more.
The decision to reopen the rest stops is one of the first actions of Virginia's new governor, Republican Bob McDonnell, who took office just this past weekend. During the campaign, he criticized his predecessor for shutting the facilities down, and yesterday he announced they'll start reopening next month.
For our travelers that come to Virginia that see tape across the entrance to the rest stop, it's a sign that Virginia is closed for business. It's exactly the opposite signal that I need to send to people across the country.
Former Governor Tim Kaine hoped to save about $9 million a year, closing about half of Virginia's rest areas. The state now plans to cut money instead from road maintenance, and also will seek private donations to fund the facilities. John Townsend of the AAA Motor Club applauded the decision. He says drivers do in fact stop more often in places where rest areas are available. But even as Virginia reopens its rest areas, New York's governor this weekend proposed closing some there. Maine, Colorado, and Vermont also have shut some down to save money. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand in California.
And I'm Melissa Block in Washington. President Obama issued fighting words today with a proposal aimed at banks that have been called too big to fail. Mr. Obama proposed new rules to limit the size of banks and to curb risky activities as part of his vision for financial regulatory reform.
My message to members of Congress of both parties is that we have to get this done. And my message to leaders of the financial industry is to work with us and not against us on needed reforms.
Bank stocks tumbled after the president's announcement. As NPR's John Idstey explains, the new rules are controversial because they could significantly reduce profits at some big banks.
The president's new proposals aim to put more distance between the two arms of banking, taking in deposits, as commercial banks do, and making risky bets, as investment banks do. The rules would prohibit commercial banks and companies that own them, like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, from owning hedge funds and private equity firms. In announcing the rules at the White House today, President Obama took on the tone of a populist reform politician.
We simply cannot accept a system in which hedge funds or private equity firms inside banks can place huge, risky bets that are subsidized by taxpayers and that could pose a conflict of interest. And we cannot accept a system in which shareholders make money on these operations if the bank wins, but taxpayers foot the bill if the bank loses.
Since trading for their own benefit, or proprietary trading as it's called, can generate big profits, the new rules may force some firms to choose between owning deposit-taking commercial banks and doing lucrative but risky proprietary trading. The president suggested that's okay.
If financial firms want to trade for profit, that's something they're free to do. Indeed, doing so responsibly is a good thing for the markets and the economy. But these firms should not be allowed to run these hedge funds and private equities funds while running a bank backed by the American people.
In addition to eliminating some of the risky activities of banks and their holding companies, President Obama wants to limit the overall size of banks, too.
The American people will not be served by a financial system that comprises just a few massive firms. That's not good for consumers. It's not good for the economy.
Bank size is already restricted in some ways. For instance, any one bank can hold no more than 10% of all the insured deposits in the country. But banks get funding in other ways, through uninsured deposits and issuing commercial paper, for instance. The president wants to limit the amount of that kind of funding a single bank can have as well. The big financial institutions and their investors did not respond well to the news. Shares in the big banks like Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America fell. Scott Talbot, an industry lobbyist at the Financial Services Roundtable, said if the president wants to reduce risk, taking away the big firms' ability to trade for their own accounts won't be helpful.
It's a tool used to manage risk. And so without that tool in our arsenal, it makes it harder, if not impossible, to manage certain risks and thereby decrease them.
Mr. Obama's proposal today is a victory for presidential adviser Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve chairman. He's been advocating a clearer separation of investment and commercial banking activities. But the Reuters News Service reported today that Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner thinks the move is putting politics ahead of good economic policy. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.